What's up, McSauce Nation? Welcome to another episode of Private Reserve. Tonight, you have all three of us here for your listening pleasure. Myself, Paul McGinty, to my right is...
Ian Sharpley.
Hello. And to my left is...
Matt Cassell.
Matt, don't shake your head. We change it up here. This is a free... It's like water. Private Reserve is a free-flowing show. Anything can happen.
It is free-flowing. We definitely do... different things, even if it's the introductions.
That is true. We are extremely structured on the show proper, aren't we?
Very regimented, yes. Well, I mean, the intro's regimented. After that.
30 seconds in, and then after that.
Yeah. All right. Arguably, housekeeping isn't even regimented.
Who could tell the difference between Private Reserve and the regular show after 30 seconds?
I don't think anybody could. It's unfortunate because this is a paid service and we're supposed to be doing something different. I guess we are kind of doing some things differently. We have a slightly different structure and a slightly different focus on Private Reserve. We give the people some different stuff, I guess.
And the different thing that we're giving the people tonight is... a review of the console wars?
Yeah, sure.
Right? Is that what you'd say, review or just a discussion?
Open-ended discussion of the book, the documentary on Paramount Network, and then just the general landscape of war that Matt and myself participated in. We're not veterans of many things, but we're definitely veterans of that war.
The documentary.
Yeah. Yeah. We each have one-up hearts on our military fatigues.
That's right. We wear green hearts.
Yeah. Green hearts and, and mushrooms.
That's so funny.
So, The Console Wars is a documentary based on the book.
That's yes. Right. By an individual named... something Blake. Jeff Blake? Jeffrey Blake?
Blake J. Or
Blake J. Jeffrey.
Blake.
The director of the film is, or produced, one of the directors is Blake J. Harris.
Could be the writer. Also,
I think that is the writer. That sounds familiar to me.
Blake J. Harris also is the writer, so he's the producer of the film, also the writer of the book, so it's good that... And maybe this is why, not to spoil everything, but maybe this is why the book and the film feel, you know, one
the documentary.
Hand in glove.
Yeah, they're definitely, they stuck close to the source material for the documentary. Now, Paul, I do believe that there is still some kind of machinations about that is going to come out with, like, an actual feature film based on the console wars. I don't know if that's for real happening. I know that Seth Rogen was attached to it.
Should we tell the people at home what the console wars are real quick? Did we mention that at
no,
all?
We didn't.
Okay.
Ian, tell me what the console wars are.
We hinted at it. For those playing at home, I wonder if they got it.
I would think that they probably do. The console wars refers to a period in the, I guess, late 80s, early 90s, whenever... Nintendo and Sega went to battle for the hearts and minds of kids and teenagers everywhere, the kinds of things that those two companies, how they waged war against each other is the basis of this book, the technological advances, mainly the marketing edge that one company had over another is the big takeaway that I always saw in the book and in the documentary series. So that's what we're talking about.
I don't remember getting Sega Power magazine in my mailbox.
Well, I mean, true, but I'm sure you remember Sega's catchphrase.
Sega?
Yeah.
Also,
I think it had a little bit more 90s attitude. You got to splash a little bit of Mountain Dew on that thing.
I have to X-slam my crotch.
You have to sprinkle some cool ranch Dorito dust all over it, and then you get the proper Sega!
Paul, I got the Sega Visions magazine. That was the magazine of the day. Sega Visions. And I can remember there was a letter that somebody wrote.
You're such a letter guy. Big letter guy.
Big letter guy here. Somebody wrote a letter. And I was reading it in Sega Visions, and they basically said, like, well, you know, first you had the Sega Master System, and now you have the Sega Genesis. You know, 5 years later, should I just wait like 5 years for the next thing? And Sega Visions was like, oh no, no, the Genesis is here to stay. This is going to be for the next blah 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 years. They were really making the case that the Sega Genesis was the end all be all.
But also, you got to take into account, video games was such a new form of entertainment. I mean, prior to the time period that you're talking about, maybe 10 years, that's when the start of real video gaming kind of happened. So there was no precedent. There was no idea about, well, how far can we push these games? I know in the documentary, they talk a lot about parents being really upset whenever kids were moving from the original Nintendo into a Super Nintendo, and people were upset because there was no backwards compatibility, and they felt like they had spent all this money on this, you know, quote unquote toy, and they put hundreds and hundreds of dollars into this very expensive entertainment system, if you will, and then essentially a couple years down the line,
how dare they, entertainment system, you do one thing. This isn't a system of entertainment.
I mean, it was, right?
No, it just played video games. It's not like it played CDs and records and television and all this other stuff. It did one thing.
Well, I mean, and maybe whenever, you know, the naysayers back in the 1980s, you know, Paul's, I don't know, cousin.
Me.
Paul, yeah, Paul.
Just me.
Yeah, Paul, whenever he worked for Nintendo and he was bitching about it. Maybe that inspired some other video game makers to say, hey, why not have a DVD player included? Why not be able to have the ability to play CDs?
Or there's probably a reason why Sega didn't call themselves the Sega Entertainment System. It was the Sega Master System. And then they
also
went with...
false. I mean, I guess you could master it.
Not over-promising, though, because it is... a like master game system. It's not declaring we own entertainment.
Right. And then they went to the Genesis, which was what it was named here in the United States. Paul, as you know, it was called the Mega Drive in Europe and Japan, Ian?
I think so, yeah.
The Mega Drive.
Yeah. So weird.
Yeah, but for some reason...
I always find that stuff so weird.
Well, you want to know what's even weirder? You know what the Nintendo was called in Japan? The Famicom.
Because your family
could calm together. I don't think I've ever heard that.
Do you know what
the Super Nintendo was called in Japan?
Mega Famicom?
Super Famicom.
Was it?
Yeah.
They should have got more creative.
I mean, they weren't very creative in their naming system for years.
Right.
Super Mario Brothers, Super Mario Brother 2.
That's not their fault. Sequel precedent had already been set.
Super Mario World. What's this on? Is this on the Nintendo 64? Super Mario 64. Donkey Kong 64.
What was Star Wars on the Super Nintendo?
Super Star Wars.
Well, they didn't have a Star Wars 64.
Empire Strikes
it's easy.
Back.
It's easy nomenclature.
What was that game about?
Rolling all that
man?
Stuff into the
Superman.
Same thing.
Superman.
In America, he was just man.
Mamacom. So yeah, Paul. It always strikes me as funny that Matt and myself are really into this particular period of video game playing, and I think we were both really, really heavily ingrained in the culture. Matt, you mentioned that you had a magazine that I've never even heard, Sega Visions. I've never heard of it.
That I read the letters to. That's how much I enjoyed
psychopath.
It.
I was a big Nintendo Power guy. Yeah. I had Nintendo Power, had a subscription. But Paul, I feel like you you know, you were too busy either working for Famicom or just, you know, what's your old go-to playing hockey and
collecting
girls.
Baseball cards,
stealing baseball cards.
I had both of these systems and I played the shit out of them.
Mm-hmm.
When, like, I remember the first time I saw a Genesis, I was like, oh my God, holy shit. Like, these poorly rendered logos look just like the NHL logos. Sort of. Yeah, like when the first time I saw Genesis blew my mind. But yeah, I had all that stuff. I think I get lost after Super Nintendo because I never had whatever happened after Genesis. And I had a Super Nintendo, but by that point it was pretty much just for Mario World. Like, I don't even know what other games I would have played on there. Street Fighter? No, that was probably Sega.
Street Fighter also was on. Yeah, the cross.
Normally, like, you guys go down the path, you start talking 64 and GameCube and all that stuff, and I'm like, I don't even know what those are. But all the early stuff, all the NES and the Super Nintendo and, like, the Genesis, I never had the Master System.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, like, all that stuff and, like, all the games that, you know, were built into those two worlds, I'm very familiar with. I had issues of Nintendo Power. I didn't have a subscription.
Yeah.
I think I just, you know, used my buddies after they were done with them.
That's an interesting way of saying steal, but okay.
Well, no, I mean, we've talked in length about stealing He-Man figures. Super Nintendos were not theft. They were actually lent to me.
So, Matt, Console Wars mainly focuses on, I think I would say that the protagonist of the book and the series is one Tom Kalinske. So he was a CEO of Mattel Toys in the early 80s, was behind the big push and some of the marketing that really pushed Barbie out to the masses and really, like, made her gain popularity in a way that was unseen before. Also, the, you know, main guy behind Hot Wheels, as well as He-Man. So some of the, like, original kind of toys from the 1980s that we really liked, and some of those big properties he was really responsible mm-hmm. for developing, and then also pushing it out to the masses.
Yeah, Tom Kalinske is definitely portrayed as the hero of the story. And Paul, frankly, he is. Because he was the shot in the arm that the industry needed to kind of propel itself beyond just being a hobby for children. Because him and Sega decided that there was an entire segment of people that was being completely ignored, and that was pretty much like the 12 to 30 or 12 to 25 age range. And even since then, obviously the video game player demographic has expanded, but at the time Nintendo had like 95% market share.
So
little old Sega comes along.
Who owned Nintendo in America?
Nintendo.
And so, but Mattel got the Sega license?
No,
and that's
no.
what allowed Tom Kalinske,
no, Tom
who worked
Kalinske,
for Mattel, to push Sega out?
No. Tom Kalinske worked for Mattel, and then one of the CEOs for Sega of Japan, because he was so well known as Maverick in the toy industry, they headhunted him.
They literally, this guy, like the CEO or the president of Sega, this crazy Japanese guy hunts him down, Tom Kalinske, while he's on a family vacation in Hawaii, and literally walks up to him while he's laying on the beach in Hawaii and basically says, hey, would you like to come to Japan with me to maybe see if you want to be the president of Sega? And he cut his vacation short. He flew out to Japan from Hawaii with crazy Japanese Nakayama, and took a look at like everything that Sega had going on. At this point, they were well underway with kind of the development of the Sega Genesis. And Paul, if you remember, the Game Gear. Do you remember the Game Gear?
Was that like a headset?
No, it was the handheld. It was Sega's answer to the Game Boy, okay. The Nintendo Game Boy.
Okay.
And the big differentiator was it was in color.
I remember.
And remember, this was like the late 80s, early 90s. And how long did it take Nintendo to catch up and have a Game Boy Color?
Like 99?
Yeah, it took another, you know, 10 years for them to catch up to that kind of technology that Genesis or Sega was putting out there.
And I think it was the Game Gear specifically that sold Kalinske. Yeah, the Genesis was cool, but I think having that little device in his hand and seeing the color and how far advanced that was compared to the Game Boy, he was like, okay, I think they're on to something here. So he said, okay. So he took the job, and at that time, Sega was nothing. They were inconsequential in the video game space. But with his leadership, he turned Sega of America, because he had two factions, I guess, like two sort of like parts to Sega. You had Sega of Japan and then Sega of America. And Sega of Japan wasn't as successful as Sega of America, even though the company is a Japanese company. And Tom Kalinske made Sega of America very successful, but I think it pissed off a lot of the people in Japan because they were basically getting shown up, and you know, there were like kind of intercompany politics at play, and there was a lot of pride and people's feelings were hurt. So it was almost like Sega of Japan then started to cut their nose off to spite their face a little bit, meaning they were making decisions that were not in the best interest of the company, just so that way it would prevent Sega of America from looking even better.
Yeah, doing things like, you know, rushing things to production or having sort of similar technology come out very close to one another, so that you can't really focus your energies on one thing or the other.
Close to the U.S. Sega or Nintendo?
Sega would be put out more, like Sega of Japan and Sega of America, they would still sell the same products and everything like that, but Sega of Japan actually was the one that made a lot of the decisions with
the technology. They called all the shots, yeah. So here, this is interesting, Paul. I bet you didn't know this, but I think you'll find it interesting. Who is currently the biggest company in video games right now?
Xbox.
Try again. Try one more time.
PlayStation.
There you go. Sony PlayStation. Before Sony had the PlayStation, they wanted to get into the video game business, so they contacted their friends at Nintendo, and they said, hey, let's do some kind of CD add-on thing for your Nintendo, and Nintendo was like, yeah, let's do it. Well, at the last minute, Nintendo decides, you know what, we're going to, thanks, but no thanks, Sony. We're going to sign our CD technology deal with Philips instead. So they kind of like spurned Sony.
And Sony had already done a lot of work on a Legend of Zelda game, if I remember correctly.
That I don't know.
I think they did. That was the game that they were working on.
Okay.
And I don't think they had any kind of like working prototype. I've never really seen any artwork, but I've heard tell that that was the game that they were trying to put on disc.
Okay.
For Nintendo. So they did all this research and development for Nintendo to make a game, and Nintendo was like, yeah, I don't think so. So then what happened?
So, well, Nintendo says, we're going to partner with Philips instead. Then they never ended up actually making anything with Philips either. But Sony was like, okay, fine. Let's talk to Sega instead. So Tom Kalinske, the hero of this story, talks to Sony, and he's like, yeah, let's do it. Let's team up between like your technology and our penchant for making games. We're going to like...
We're gonna
make Nintendo wish they were never born.
We're gonna bury them jagoffs.
Yeah. So everything's a go until Sega of Japan's like, no. We don't want you to partner with Sony. And so Sony got screwed over twice.
So then what did Sony do?
So here's a little, we're going to cut to the end. You know who won the console war between Nintendo and Sega?
Neither of them.
Sony. Sony was the winner and is still the winner to this day. From a war that was fought in 1991. So, Sony decided they were just going to make their own thing, and it destroyed the
competition. It seemed to work out pretty well.
It seemed to work out pretty well. If Sega would have been more allowed to operate under Sega of America's leadership, because the proof was in the pudding. They were very successful doing it the American way. And if they had been allowed to continue on that trajectory, I think the video game landscape would be very different today. But Sega was destined to be their own worst enemy. I mean,
just makes games now?
They just make games, and they are a shell of their former self. To this day, I hope that there has been a long-standing rumor that Microsoft is going to buy Sega. And I would love that. I think that would be cool, because I think at least then you would get a steady stream of games, probably put out with some kind of Western influence, which again, I think is when Sega is at its best, because they've got a lot of great IP, but it's just stagnant. It's just sitting there. It's doing nothing.
What are Sega's top three IPs?
Sonic the Hedgehog is easily their number one. Then after that, it gets a little bit weird. Maybe Monkey Ball would be the next one.
Even yikes.
I don't know. What do you think, Ian?
I mean, don't research it.
They also have like the Total War PC series. It's popular. They also have Football Manager, which is also popular.
So they have Sonic.
They have Sonic. But like for me, Golden Axe.
Do they still have Earthworm Jim?
Earthworm Jim.
I'm throwing back like.
Was not Sega, though.
What was Crash Bandicoot?
That's a PlayStation.
That was a Sony game that they eventually sold to Activision.
I think that what some of the takeaways from what happened in the console wars wasn't necessarily the games. It was part of it was the games, in the way that Sega leaned into like sports games really hard, and that was something that captured a different kind of audience. But the main thing was that video games were, in Sega's eyes, Sega saw themselves as the next level or a step up, or when you were done playing with your childish Nintendo stuff and you're done playing Super Mario, then you step up to more adult games, Mortal Kombat, and even Sonic had more of an edge.
Wait, would you say that's what Sony felt?
That's what Sega thought.
Eventually just what Sony did.
And that's what Sega did first, and really good.
I feel like that's kind of still what it is. Like Nintendo still feels like kids stuff.
Yeah.
And like, if you want to get your sports games or like your more adult geared games, like you're not going to find that on Nintendo. And whenever Wii came out, I was like, "Oh, this is very juvenile."
Yeah. The kind of marketing that Sega had, which is a main focal piece of the documentary, in the like sort of like it's so quintessential 1990s ad, like it's just like the flat, very fast cutting, and it feels like a video or like a video from MTV kind of.
It was, but when it came out, it is what defined the 90s. Like it set the precedent, and everything else followed. It was what established the 90s to be what the 90s were, in my opinion.
Yeah, were those like Sega ads, which then trickled into essentially everything, because
everything.
It became teen culture. It became youth culture, was that kind of thing. And that's what Sega was trying to harness, was we want the teenagers and college kids. And it just dominated the 1990s.
Yeah,
like, aesthetic, I guess.
Nintendo finally took notice and started to mimic the style of the Sega ads around the end of the... Maybe, I guess it was kind of the end of the Super Nintendo era with Donkey Kong Country.
Yeah, and then Sony did the same thing.
Then Sony did the same thing.
They had a guy in a Crash Bandicoot sort of outfit going to Nintendo's offices and getting
with
on
a megaphone.
Megaphone and yelling stuff. And it was like the natural extension of what Sega started in like 1991 all the way into like 1996, 97 by a totally different company.
Yeah. So here's the thing, like, and I've told people this that I know aren't into video games. I legitimately think that this book and this documentary, regardless of your interest in video games, it helps. But even if you're not into video games, like, it's a good story. It's a story more about marketing and strategy and a bit of a period piece. So if you like the early 90s, it's probably also going to be interesting. You don't like early 90s?
Nope. Hate them.
Interesting.
Yeah, I kind of want to watch it. I get the sense that it's going to be like a few episodes of Toys That Made Us, just in the sense that a couple of those episodes, I didn't really give a shit about the toy, and then I watched the episode, and I was like, oh, this was pretty neat. So, yeah. Like, I'm not intimately invested in the console wars, but I think the story itself would be enough to be like, oh, man, that was pretty cool.
What's really fun is that they have a lot of the creators from both sides, from Nintendo and from Sega. They're all still alive. They're all still able to retell the stories in pretty vivid detail. One thing that's really fun about the documentary is a lot of when you go and you're doing sort of like dramatic reenactions, right? Instead of having actors come in and do it, they have like 16-bit graphics play out the scenes in sort of over-exaggerated ways, and some of the things that happen where maybe some programmers from Sega and Nintendo, I think they got into
like a fight,
but like the way that they tell it in the documentary, it looks
like a fighting game.
Like Altered Beast.
It's somebody
or Street Fighter
rips their skin off and they become a werewolf, you know, how it really was in the 1990s. But that part's kind of fun as well, just seeing the reenactments in that 1990s, you know, bitmapped style.
Yeah, it's really an interesting story about how a company was able to not only put a dent in essentially a monopoly of what Nintendo controlled, but to actually overtake Nintendo for a short time. It's like a David versus Goliath type of story with entertainment and business. And I think it's fascinating to see a company like Nintendo be so reluctant to take seriously the competition I can't say until it was too late, because ultimately Nintendo recovered and they're very successful today, but they waited way too long to put Sega in their place. They let Sega do so much that they never should have. Sega never should have been allowed to rise up like they did, but Nintendo was a very, frankly, backwards company, a very arrogant company. And the funniest thing of all is both of the companies were so laser focused on one another that a third player came in and completely claimed victory.
Yeah, I think at some point I'll dig into Paramount Plus and check it out. Because like, I do know this stuff. This isn't like a foreign thing to me. It isn't like if you guys were like, hey, watch this, you know, FIFA World Championship 2002 documentary, then I'd be like, absolutely not. But like, this is something that, you know, I did grow up with. I played with both of these systems, had a lot of the games. So yeah, I think I'll try to check it out in the next couple weeks.
It's a bit of a nostalgic trip for sure.
Well, for you guys, for sure. You 90s kids. But
that's what I'm saying. Like, if you grew up in the 90s, then it's going to really resonate. Even it doesn't even necessarily have to be video games, because it's like all things 90, because like this kind of stuff permeated pop culture, you know? So yeah. it's just like pop culture of the 90s, and it'll resonate with you if you're familiar with it.
Yeah, really well-made documentary.
It even turned Ian into a Sega fan. He says Nintendo.
What a terrible joke. Yeah, I'd be interested to hear any feedback from any fans out there. I know we have a lot of video game fans that may or may not have watched this. So if you do check out Console Wars, hit us up on all the social medias and let us know what you think about it.
Where can people see Console Wars?
Paramount Network or
Paramount Plus.
Paramount Plus or CBS All Access. They're two separate things.
I thought Paramount Plus became... CBS All Access became Paramount Plus. I think
you might still be able to get it, because whenever I watch some commercials, it still has both logos.
When I looked it up last week, it came up as Paramount Plus.
Okay, so maybe it's just strictly on Paramount.
But yeah. Comcast or Xfinity seemed a little nebulous about what would happen if I pushed play. I didn't know if I'd automatically be loaded up for Plus or just... So I was like, meh. Maybe I'll wait till I'm really invested in this to dive on, you know, make that jump.
For those of you out there that are more readers, there's a book out. You can also listen to the audiobook. That's how Matt and myself listen to it originally.
It's got great narration. The narrator's name is Fred Berman, and I've listened to a few books by him, actually. Really
such
good.
A weird guy, Matt.
What?
Like, yeah, of course I've got my favorite audiobook reader. His name's Fred Berman. I listen to a lot of his work.
I can't pull, in Matt's defense, I can't think of the guy who reads the Gunslinger books, the Dark Tower books, but there were two different guys that read them, and there was one guy that really sounded like a grizzled cowboy, and then as the later books come in, I think they get rid of him for a couple of books, and it definitely changes the feel of how you interact with that world when it's no longer the person that you feel like you should hear it from.
Give Fred Berman a listen. You'll see.
I will certainly give Fred Berman a listen. That's going to do it for this episode of Private Reserve. My name is Paul McGinty.
Sharply.
Fred Berman.
And we will see you next, Fred Berman.